We're just going to be continuing a point made with regard to the issue of Moshe. Did Moshe speak Lashon Hara? He will speak that the Jews said that they will not believe me. When they listen to my voice, they will say that God did not appear to you. In accordance with the literal sense of the words, it seems to be saying that Moshe seems to be definite. He's making a statement, reaching a conclusion. However, in accordance with the interpretation of the Rambam and the Mura, that's not really meant. What he really meant to say is that he doesn't expect people to simply believe him when he comes to them and makes a claim which is so amazing or outlandish as the one he's going to make. That is to say that God spoke to him. In general, people should not blindly accept the claims of another individual. Even if it's not pertaining to something significant, as this is a very significant idea. And it's kind of strange that when it comes to religious matters, people are extremely gullible and are willing to accept things without evidence, without real proof. And in effect, it's their entire, so to speak, spiritual life. It's a very significant matter, especially these people that maintain their beliefs. Because they're not just a question of willing to accept certain religious stories or religious obligations. It's more than that. It cuts people's lives, causes them to avoid indulging certain types of behaviors which they might otherwise want to indulge because of the guilt of sin. They introduce this concept into their life called sin, and that has tremendous consequences, psychological consequences. The extent to which people suffer, religion contributes a great deal of misery, not only in terms of aggression, the wars that are fought because of religion, but even aside from that, in terms of people trying to achieve some type of a decent or happy kind of an existence, there are plenty of barriers too, obstacles that are put into the system. And making it not so simple. It's not easy to have a comfortable, happy existence, and among the various factors that contribute to human religion is conscious. Also, with regard to the issues pertaining to eternal life, most people embrace a religion. I'm talking now about religion in general, the world stands it. Because fear is the essential motivation. What did Judaism add of this? I don't want to lump Judaism together with other religions. That would be disrespectful. I'm repeating. I'm talking about other religions. Most people embrace it simply because of fear. Simply because Rambam talks about the issue of motivation. In Hilchos Tshuva, Joseph Tshuva, in the final chapter, he talks about serving God out of love. That a person should not say that he's going to serve God in order to achieve the benefits, rewards, so to speak. Benefits is not a good word, rewards. A person should serve God to achieve the benefits. We maintain that everything that God ordained in the Torah is beneficial. However, for what is known as the rewards, that is what people commonly imagine, the things that are outside of the framework of nature, whether they be in this world physical rewards. People imagine that that's the way this is over here, and if you do the right things, you serve God, you obey, you're going to get good things. Because you're a good boy and you get rewarded, or you're a good girl and you're going to get rewarded. That's one side of that coin. That the other side of the coin, of course, it's intricately connected, is the side of punishment. Everybody wants to avoid pain and to increase pleasure. And religion, for many people, is simply one of those ways in which to do so, sort of bypassing the natural order. So the Rambam said that a person should not say that, because that's false, that's not the correct basis. Nevertheless, he doesn't prohibit it, which doesn't expect people to be on a sophisticated level to be able to recognize that Judaism is not about reward punishment in terms of the foundation. That Judaism is a correct system, it's the appropriate way to live one's life, leading a person towards the ultimate goal. However, the reality is that most religious people, Jewish and non-Jewish, turn to religion out of fear. And they accept the religion because they believe that this is the one that's going to alleviate their problem. They cling to the religion in spite of the fact that what they imagine to be like and how they imagine it to be working, it doesn't work that way. There's a tremendous amount of denial about staying religious for many people. Because when they perform talking with still got and they do what they're supposed to do. And the only reason they do it is simply because whatever reason they believe that this irrational kind of behavior is going to influence the powers that be and bring about certain results, it just doesn't work out that way. And you will not see any statistical difference between those who follow these rituals and those who don't. Nobody thinks to approach it from that. All Jews as well. Those people who have these expectations, they have special protection. because of the religious activity they're engaging in, they didn't think to study the situation, the reality. And there's no doubt in my mind that if you did a statistical study with groups, first of all, you have groups of people that either are totally irreligious or groups of people that follow a completely different religion, which from this point of people of a different religion, those who are following a different religion are like as if they're no religion, because according to them, it's a false religion, so it shouldn't produce any positive results. I don't think you're going to find any statistical difference in terms of any of the things that people desire or are afraid of, in terms of health, in terms of disease, in terms of wealth, in terms of winning lottery, in terms of any of these things. You're not going to be able to prove any statistical difference to the outcome, other than, mention other factors. Actual factors. It may be that people who are devoutly religious may have a better, in terms of the family, because they're serious about things of that sort, and so therefore they may avoid the problems that other people who don't have these restrictions would incur. That's an issue. I'm not telling you that's an accidental result. That's not what they have in mind. They don't have in mind that they're going to become religious for purely practical, rational considerations. I'm talking in terms of the supernatural phenomena, those things which, based upon their belief, that their supernatural forces work. And that's the ones they want to influence, and as a result of these practices, going to get a certain outcome, outcome-oriented religion. It's absolutely absurd, because you already have 2,000 years of history now and records to check and see whether it works. So why does the person continue it? When it doesn't work. All these decisions people make without any study of the evidence. Religious decisions are the most irrational in the human framework. What happens is that once a religion is established, if someone successfully makes an inroad in the first instance, then the chances of success increase dramatically, because once you're dealing with the second generation, third generation, once it's an inherited phenomenon, and you're brainwashing children, you have children that are inculcated these principles and the principles of the religion, and embedded in their minds, and in the conscience, in the super-ego, and all the emotions that go along with the belief system of the reverence, of not being allowed to question, of having to believe. These are very powerful phenomena. The closing of the mind, and it becomes perpetuated. What you create is a being who doesn't have the capacity to exercise any judgment, any free will, with regard to the fundamental issues of the religion. So therefore, people should be very careful about accepting claims, of course, of a religious nature, but even in other areas. We should question. We should accept something. We should question the capability of the individual, the proficiency, his expertise, our expertise, the trustworthiness of the individual, and what they're saying, whether it makes sense or whether it doesn't make sense. People should be very discriminating, very discerning, before they just accept something that somebody else says. That's even if somebody is a highly intelligent person that's saying it. So that's basically what Moshe Rabbeinu is saying. They don't believe me. In saying that, if you understand it, it's what? It's saying, he's saying, in spite of the fact that it's logical, that it makes sense, that they have a defect, they're not going to accept it, they're not reasonable people, so then it's a criticism. But if it's merely meant to point out that it's necessary that these people are going to question, and I need to have proof, that's basically what he's looking for, and that's just what God responds to, because God gives him the signs to demonstrate to them, so then it becomes difficult to see where Moshe Rabbeinu is accusing the Jewish people of defect. Moshe Rabbeinu, in requesting signs from God, one great question, was he requesting them because he personally needed them for his own conviction? Or was it simply for the sake of demonstrating to us? If we're going to say that he needed them for his own conviction, then we're going to have a problem. Because you see that the Avos, who came before Moshe, the patriarchs, followed, obedient to the will of God, which they received in prophecy, and they never asked for any kind of demonstration. For example, Abraham was prepared to go to sacrifice his son Yitzchak on the basis of the prophecy. He could ask the question before doing so, should he not ask for some kind of a proof? Abraham Avinu did not ask for any kind of a proof. That this is exactly what God wants. And if he would go ahead and do so, then he had the message correct. He didn't need any type of demonstration. Because the prophet, the one who receives the prophecy, is absolutely certain. That's his body. That's part of prophecy. There's no doubt in his mind. Indeed, that's what the Rambam says in the Mora, that one of the purposes of the text of the Akedah was to demonstrate the truth, the veracity of a prophecy. For someone like Rambam would not have done like that unless there's no doubt at all that that's what he wanted. It was absolute as far as he was concerned. Moshe Rabbeinu over here is asking for signs, not because he is in doubt in terms of God's will, in terms of mission. However, the people he's gone to, they didn't experience the prophecy. So they have a legitimate question. How do I know that you're a messenger of God? How do I know that? You have to convince me now. And since I'm not a prophet, I will not get prophetic message from God. So you have to convince me a term in the framework that I can relate to. I can demonstrate through a sign, a change, significant change in the order of nature, that constitutes visible proof, demonstrable proof for me. The way we explained it was that, according to Rashi, according to the rabbis of the Talmud, Moshe was rebuked in a sense, was smitten in fact, for speaking Lashon Hara, evil speech against Jews. And this was expressed in the first two signs, the staff turning into a snake. The snake was a reminder that he sinned evil speech. That's what the snake represented, the snake in the Garden of Eden, which utilized the umnus method, seduction speech. So that was, and then was engaging in the same type of activity when he spoke Lashon Hara. Second sign, which is turned into Saras. So thus, to a certain extent, he was actually afflicted. For that amount of time, we don't know how long it was, that his hand remained outside, and it had been stricken with leprosy, Saras, actually was bodily afflicted. That's what the rabbis say. If one suspects Choshe B'Cherim, suspects a right person of sin, he's smitten bodily, punishment, bodily affliction. We learned this question. So, the problem was, how do we resolve it? How do we reconcile the fact that on a certain level, on the overt level, the question of Moshe was legitimate. He had a right to ask the proof. And God indeed gave him the proofs. So if that's the case, how could it be Lashon Hara? The explanation that I gave was that it's a different type of Lashon Hara. It was not an overt sin. But from the way he phrased the question, he phrased it as a question. He didn't say, if they didn't have proof, what shall I give them? As he did phrase the question about God's name. They will ask your name, what shall I say? It's appropriate. He already seems to have jumped to a conclusion. He came to a conclusion by saying, they will not believe me, nor will they listen to me. They will say that God did not speak to you, by already stating the point as a conclusion. It means that he's indicating that at a certain level, it was more than just the essence of the proof, that he thought that the Jews partook of a certain type of a defect, and they didn't have the ability to become true believers, to be able to achieve a level of certainty in the existence of God that would be necessary to become a Ma'amin. And therein lies the rebuke. That was not justified. And that's why he's been criticized. This would explain the fact that there was no true punishment over here, but punishment, so to speak, was derech emes, was through a hint, through an indication. In terms of the snake, and it wasn't really a matter that it was purely a scientific experiment. The snake appeared and he ran for it. He experienced the fright, he experienced the shock. That too, to a certain extent, constitutes a bit of an affliction. And then you have the case of the tzaraas. That explains, that resolves the interpretation of the Chazal, which is not on the surface level. On the surface level, Moshe is not doing anything wrong. It's simply his way of evading that he's proof. And God responds to that. However, on a different level, it was essential to point out, to hint to Moshe, that God, of course, knows the thoughts of a person. That the way he framed the question indicated that he harbored doubt about the Jews, and it's essential for a leader who's going to effectuate changes in the people to, if he is burdened, if he has certain convictions, and convinced that people can't reach a certain level, that's going to have an impact, a negative impact upon his whole mission. There are two questions that remain from the shiur that was given on the subject. One question was that before giving Moshe the sign, the staff of a snake, there's a preface. God prefaces it and says, Pasuk Beis, chapter 4, Pasuk Beis, and God said to him, what is that in your hand? Vayomer Mateh. And he said, it's a staff. Interestingly, we note Rashi, the word Mazeh, what is that in your hand? It's really two words, but it's written as one word. Rashi takes note of that and says it's written as one word to lead you to this drasha, to interpretation. You should read this. This sentence is really Mizeh. The way it's spelled, it also can be read as Mizeh. From this. From that which is in your hand, you are guilty. You're chayiv lildos. You're chayiv. You're guilty, serving of being smitten because you were chodeh b'sherim. You were suspicious of kosher people of chayiv. Our question, however, is what is the purpose of this entire part of the dialogue? So I could simply take this and throw it on the ground. Now Rashi then proceeds to explain plain meaning, upshuto, but the plain meaning of the text is to adam she'ol avera. It's like a person said to his friend, Modeata shezu shelfencha evan hi. Do you acknowledge, you agree, that that which is in front of you is a stone? Omer lo hein. He says yes. Omer lo, and then he says, Hareini oda osaid. I'm going to make him to wood. So Rashi's thing is that if you're going to have a sign, you're going to form a sign, but for it to be effective, it has to be done in a controlled way, in a correct way. And the entire effect of the sign is dependent upon how it's done. Because you have to take into consideration always the skepticism. There's always a difference. So that a person, after the fact, might deny, might have thought afterwards. Hearer might not be convinced. He might have thoughts. Well, maybe I'm too close. I should look like a magician does a trick. Everybody knows it's a trick. You try to look very closely. You want to make sure that he's not putting anything over on you. So God is saying to him, before you first establish, well, what is that? What do you have in your hand? Let's establish what it is. Look at it. Look very carefully. So you should be afterwards. I should look more carefully. Look what it is. Then what? In your category, in your framework is staff. Okay, it's a snake. There's no way it's a snake. That you'd be running away from this. Okay, cast it on the ground, you have the action, then it becomes a snake. And by Yonah, you away. That's the completion of the test. However, my question would be, would this really be necessary for someone like Moshe? I could see for an ordinary person, a person that has reasons to be doubtful and resistant and so forth, they might afterwards go, oh, 1 second, do it again, I wasn't looking closely enough. This leads us to perhaps a solution to another question. And that is, why, in response to Moshe, why did God have to actually demonstrate the signs he was supposed to Moshe? Why didn't he just tell him what to do? With regard to the signs that he demonstrated to Paro with regard to plagues, as far as we see, he told him what to do. God had him act out for us, like a practice run. Even over here, he offered the third one, the water, take the water of the Nile, and it'll turn to blood. That's nothing reactive. That's simply a command. He's telling Moshe what to do at the appropriate time. So, all we needed over here, all that was needed after Moshe made the problem. If you will not believe me, all that was needed was that God would tell him what to do. Why couldn't God tell him? Take your staff and throw it on the ground. And God could have told him, if that's not enough, take your hand and put it inside your cloak. But that's, it's strange that God actually has him do it. It would seem that having Moshe actually do that, so to speak, it was like a trial run. But when you raise the question, well, the question is, why was there a necessity for that? It could be two possible reasons. I mean, on the one hand, we see that it was more than just a sign to them, but it contained a message from Moshe. Rashi makes this point, that the idea of Moshe being abused, Moshe being punished for this type of Lashon Hara, is very significant. Rashi on Ches, that if they don't listen, they don't hear, they don't listen to the voice of the first sign, then they will believe the voice of the latter sign. So Rashi says, Mishtomolem, you tell them, Mishvilchem, Lachisi. You tell them, you explain to them, that I was written because of you. Because I spoke Lashon Hara about you. Aminu Lacha. Then they'll believe you. Shekhalam Dubaka. They know this already. That those who join together to harm them, Lokim Megayim, are smitten with plagues. Yomparo Vavi Melech Bishvilsa. What you see from this point of Rashi is that the signs are not simply changes of nature to demonstrate a supernatural control over the force of nature, but they also, in addition to that, have a specific message attached to them. And Moshe is supposed to explain that. If we have to assume they would encounter this question, what's the significance of the snake? What's the significance of the hand turning into us? What's the meaning of that? It's a very fascinating idea. See, everything is limud. Everything is a form of teaching, of communicating ideas and information. Even this. What's that meaning? It has to have a significance. It can't be take something and throw it on the floor and turn it into something else. That wouldn't make sense. That would be arbitrary, purely arbitrary. That the acts of God are arbitrary. I assume, according to Rashi, that Moshe would have to be prepared to explain all facets of the demonstration. Doesn't mean that everybody there would ask. You're talking about a lot of people. Essentially, Moshe was supposed to gather the elders, the wise ones, and he would answer their questions. He assumed that they would ask him the name of God. What shall I tell them? Then he's looking for these signs. There too, Kuzi Rashi is going to want to understand what's the meaning of these signs. What's the reason? Moshe would explain. Now Rashi says that the message has to do with rebuke to Moshe Rabbeinu. And they'll want to know why, what's place. And they'll explain to them that he spoke Lashon Hara. Now the Lashon Hara that he spoke, I'm being raised, I thought. The Lashon Hara that Moshe spoke, I wouldn't consider it might have a bad effect. People would be upset that he spoke Lashon Hara. But the way they've explained it, it's not kind of Lashon Hara people are going to get upset about. That is true. They didn't say anything overtly negative, but merely by stating his question in a manner which indicated on a certain level he may not have felt that they were on the highest level of Muna. That's not the kind of thing that's going to create a problem. But what Rashi points out is that the people would be impressed by what he says, that this truth, because this would confirm what they've received. That those who line up against them are smitten. That the Jews are under a special providence. And that goes to Avraham Avinu, because even though there wasn't a Jewish nation at the time, but that was the status of the other, they achieved that type of a level where they were, in effect, the representation of Klal Yisrael, of the Jewish people. I want to address the question that we mentioned yesterday. Why was it necessary for two separate rebukes, the snake and the god? I was thinking that in Lashon Hara really entails two big sins. One is affected by the nachash, by the snake, umnaso, the modus operandi of the snake, which is what the snake sought to thwart the will of God and utilize the power of seduction, the power of speech. So to the extent that a person engages in the activity of Lashon Hara, especially with what's being said, but it partakes of general sin, the general defect, it's a negation of God, then it's seeing itself on the fact that speech, that a person can affect the course of events through speech, through influence, through using their power of influence. That's the general idea behind Lashon Hara. That's the methodology of the snake. It seeks to bypass the will of God by seducing people. That's one aspect. That's the umnus. However, in terms of Lashon Hara, there's another aspect. Aside the fact that a person is reverting to a certain type of a behavior, a primitive, instinctual type of a rebelliousness, it also is significant in terms of actual content of a person saying. For example, rabbis say that Kala posel, mimuma posel, that whoever negates others, disqualifies others, it generally stems from their own defect. Which means that people, when they harp a particular subject, like to accuse others of something, it stems from their own type of a defect, which is known as projection, the mechanism of projection. So that, if a person wants to perfect themselves, to deal with the sin of Lashon Hara, there's two different levels. One is their whole attitude towards the illness, towards the utilization of speech, what activity they're engaging in. Trying to grab a hold of that and to deal with underlying elements behind that type of a behavior. That would be reflected by the snake. The whole approach to behavior is like the snake. It's an instinctual type of a phenomenon in which there's a negation of the power of God and the attempt to influence the outcome of events by speech. The sin won't be particular. Aside from assuming the fact that you're engaging in Lashon Hara, there's an element, and that is the specific content, what you said, to learn from the people can learn a lot about themselves, from that which you said about others. It's interesting to note that the Chazal, the rabbi, said that in the rebuke to Moshe, you accuse them of a lack, of a deficiency in the arena of Emunah, you're destined to have your own devil in this area. It's thus making the connection, the content itself. That has to do with the specific. Second one, with regard to Moshe B'Sherim, the casting aspersions on innocent people, is directly, specifically, the area of Emunah. It's a different aspect of Lashon Hara. The person should study Lashon Hara in general terms, the general defect, but then there's the particular aspect. What is it that you look about to tie it back on personality in order to take a correction in terms of a defect that you self possess? Lashon Hara indicates a defect that you possess that you're unwilling to fix yourself and which you therefore project onto others. To sum it up, therefore, we now have explained that there was a reason. There were two reasons. In this case, why God did not simply tell Moshe what to do, but God had Moshe act out the demonstration in the two, but not in the third. The first two had two purposes. In terms of the snake, in terms of the sign of the snake, we see that God first asked him, what is that in your hand? He was therefore teaching him the proper manner in which to conduct, in which to act it out. Telling him that you can't do it. Go ahead. You have to have the proper situation, the proper setting, and people have to be set up properly, appropriately. And that begins with they themselves must testify. Of course, there's a contrast methodology, magic. And magic is you hidden. You can't. You want to get close and see what's underneath the covering. You open the box. He makes a way of opening it. It's more than you want to see. You keep fighting. You must have a distance. However, in performing a genuine sign, from Hashem, the contrary, what's that in your hand? Identify it. So it's clear to you. That's the way you have to demonstrate it. So that afterwards they can't come back and say, well, who knows, maybe it was something that's like a staff, but it was one of those snakes. I heard about people in India, they have snakes that can be made very stiff and they can look like a cane or something along those lines. That may be the case. But it can't be the case in this situation. It also has a secondary reason of communicating a message. The sign that was chosen communicated a specific message. We saw that to be the case with regard to the two. With regard to the third, Moshe didn't do anything. Moshe did not act it out. It was not sent to you. One can argue that that's war of the Nile, even the wilderness, but I don't think you need that argument. There, neither one of these two factors will pertain. Because first of all, nobody's in the Nile, that's the Nile. With regard to a specific object that you can hold hands there, so then I need to identify. What is this? What's in front of you? But if we're going to take some water from the ocean and turn it into blood, this is the ocean. With regard to the other aspect, the message, it did contain a message. Third sign also contained a call, a message. The message says that God, when he punishes a nation, first deals with their idols. And the Nile was an idol. So he was smiting Nile to teach them a lesson. That their basic mistake, the prayer that they made was to ascribe divinity to something which was created. To ascribe power to Nile. That was not necessary to be enacted. The message there did not pertain to Moshe. So therefore, the third one, there was no enactment that actually told him what to do at the appropriate time. So you see from the third one that it wasn't necessary to let Moshe practice, so to speak, the signs before he did them. Rather, in the case of the first two, each one of them was necessary for a particular purpose.